From cartoons to cows, peanut butter and jelly sandwiches to cowboys, just what is the message? Hello, you are tuned in to the Ears on Art segment of Issues and Ideas. Ears on Art is produced at the studios of listener-supported KCBX Public Radio, serving the California Central Coast from Ventura to Salinas. I am Stephen DeLuque. Co-host Krista Hewitt and I continue our conversation with cartoonist and artist Jerry Scott. Jerry writes the dialogue for the comic strips Zits and Baby Blues. Krista and I met up with Jerry at his rural Arroyo Grande home and studio.
Earlier, when you were talking about devouring the comics in the morning with flashlight, Nancy obviously was not at the top of your list. What was?
Nancy was in the paper there. I always thought it was dumb. So she wasn't at the top of my list. I've never been one of the kids that liked the adventure strips or the superhero strips for some reason. Maybe that was too much reading for me. So I never said I was an intellectual. But I liked Beetle Bailey. I liked strip about a dog named Rivets, The Riots, I believe it was called, the family. There was a strip by Charles Kuhn called Grandma. As a kid, I just thought it was hilarious. And the whole conceit of that strip was Grandma, this obviously really old lady with a big cleft, like Popeye chin, and a little hair bun. She would outdo the kids at sports. And that was the joke. Every week it was the same joke. Baseball, she'd hit a home run. Hockey, she'd score a goal. And for some reason, that appealed to me. And I won't apologize for it.
Oh, absolutely not.
At that time, when I was delivering newspapers and comic strips were changing, I was probably having my paper out in 1964 or something like that. So Charles Schulz with Peanuts was gaining a lot of popularity and changing the way comics were done, simplifying it, putting adult concepts and language in these kids' mouths, and it was so funny. He was a huge influence on me. The artwork in Beetle Bailey was really important to me. BC, about the cavemen, mm-hmm. Interesting concept. All those guys, and they were mostly guys, were heroes of mine. And then when I started doing comics, I got the chance to meet most of them and call most of them friends, which was just the craziest development to happen. But I would say probably Charles Schulz was maybe the biggest influence as far as my writing goes.
Mm-hmm. Calvin and Hobbes?
Boy, Bill did a great comic strip, didn't he? It was Calvin was a huge influence, and I probably stole way too many pieces of Calvin, more than I want to admit.
I think part of my sense of that similarity would be the adult-child interaction. Mm-hmm. And again, he was presenting the parents who were not the Dennis the Menace kind of adult in the room yelling or just get away from me, you're bugging me. This was just, how does this kid do what?
Bill struck on this wonderful imagination of a 6, 7, 8-year-old boy, and was able to tap into that and that innocence and intelligence, and then Calvin's confidence, was so great. So many guys, but girls too, just I think recognized themselves in Calvin, mm-hmm. and that was his genius. That was Bill's genius, and I wish he'd done it for longer, but he did it for as long as he wanted to, mm-hmm. and then just closed up shop.
That was a very sad day.
That and Far Side, welcome. Mm-hmm. I remember when you gave a presentation at the San Luis Library a few years ago and talking about the time sequence of how a strip gets developed. We think of them as, it was done yesterday.
Yeah, there's a longer deadline. There doesn't have to be because of technology. We work on Baby Blues and Zits probably about 2 months ahead of when they're published in the newspaper. And that gives us this great safety net. Believe it or not, stuff happens to cartoonists. you get the flu, or there's a personal problem and you can't work every single day, it's great to have a little bit of time there. And so we try to pad that as much as possible. So for us, it's about 8 weeks ahead of publication. For some cartoonists I know, it's more like 4 weeks. For a guy like Gary Trudeau, when Gary is doing dailies, he was only about a week ahead of publication, which is
brutal, I would imagine. But he also was choosing to be topical.
Right.
Am I hearing that if somehow all of a sudden there was some major something that you needed to incorporate, you could pull something that you had done before and plop it in?
That's happened before. Probably more often is that we'd have to pull something out.
Right.
Because the way the world works now with the 24-hour news cycle, it's really hard to write jokes about something that could be a tragedy someplace else.
Right.
We try not to do any toss-off comments about airplane crashes or car crashes or explosions. Because, oh, my God, because that stuff happens and everybody knows about it. There can be a tragedy in Azerbaijan and everybody feels it here because we've all seen pictures and heard it. Oh. How insensitive can you be? And that's really hard to explain away.
Right.
So we're extremely careful, and we have all those eyes, those editorial eyes at the syndicates who kind of watch out for that stuff for us too. But sometimes stuff happens.
Mentioned at the beginning of this conversation that cartooning is not all that you do, and we've had a brief tour of your home and a lot of wonderful paintings that are hanging up, and you've had some exhibits here locally in San Luis. That life, I'm pretty sure, is yours and that you're not collaborating specifically with somebody else. And I am delighted to say that you're very fond of cows. But we're also sitting here looking at a peanut butter and jelly sandwich that's 1, 2, 3 layers thick.
And lots of jelly.
And lots of jelly oozing out. You've been painting, drawing for a long time?
I got the idea that I would like to paint maybe 15 or 20 years ago. And I took a class at Allen Hancock College. I loved it. And then I got busy. Had to just put that aside. And then about 10 years ago, again, I just felt the need to exercise other muscles. Doing the comic strips is collaboration in my case. And the work's really little. and I felt the need to kind of stretch and make some marks on a surface myself. Because the other guys, Jim, Rick, they do all the artwork that everybody sees. Put it in like football terms, I'm the blocking guy on the line. I'm doing all the ugly work, and they're prancing into the end zone. Because everybody's, oh, you draw baby blues. Yes, I do. Oh, you draw zits. Yes, I do. Nobody says, oh, you write all the jokes. That's dull. Nobody stands up and claps for the screenwriter after a great movie, do they? So I just thought, I want to do something. I want to make marks that are larger than, 1 inch by 6 inches. And that's why I started painting. And my first paintings were large format portraits of some of my daughter's friends when she was in middle school. I thought it would be a great series of middle schoolers because they're so awkward and they're so full of themselves.
Which I'm sure you were saying right up front, would you pose for me because you're so awkward enough?
I really won them over, yeah. And they were terrible paintings. I never finished most of them, but it got me hooked. And then I found over the last 10 years or so that I need that, getting up out of my chair and away from humor, just to paint big, bold paintings. And it sort of balances my life. And I really find that if I don't paint, I get really hard to live with. My wife understands it now, and she said, paint.
Please.
I don't know. I find it interesting and confusing, terribly complicated, impossible to master kind of way to spend time. And I don't know. I guess I like solving problems, and that's why I keep at it.
It's funny that you should say that, because we often bring up the fact that the creative process is mostly about solving problems and figuring things out. The creative part is not nearly as important as figuring out how to get what you have up here in your head into a form that the public can see.
Yeah, yeah. How to make it look like what you're seeing up there in your head. It almost never comes out well. But it's a really good point. The technical aspect of oil painting, the chemistry of it, drying times of different colors, and the mediums that can change that and adjust that, speed up or slow down the drying, and what happens if you thin the paint, what happens if you blop it on, and that is a technical term, blop it on. Mm-hmm. Some people call
it. Oh, absolutely.
I guess I should say impasto. But what I love that part of figuring it out, and I sort of like reinvent the wheel every painting. I vow to remember how I did something, and I don't. I forget it, and I start over again. And one of the things I'm learning most recently is as my color mixing is getting better, and I used to worry about the palette, you know, am I using the right colors? Because everybody knows if you just use the right colors, you get a great painting. Yeah. Which isn't exactly true. And now it doesn't matter which colors I use almost. I did the Zorn palette the other day, a cowboy herding the cattle in there. That's four colors. It's white, it's black, it's a red, and a yellow ochre. And how in the world you can get green out of that, I don't know, but it worked. And I'm just fascinated with that, and it unifies a painting, you know, for me at least, to cut down on the numbers of colors. I can look at a color now and almost say, all right, I know what I need, and it's wonky as heck. I'm sorry, but it's exciting.
No, it isn't.
You are listening to Ears on Art, a segment of Issues and Ideas produced at the studios of KCBX Public Radio in San Luis Obispo, California. Today's guest is cartoonist and artist Jerry Scott.
I've described the peanut butter and jelly sandwich, but a large portion of what is here is ranch life, cows, horses, cowboys. Yeah. You're saying that this allows you to set the humor aside, but almost all of these make me laugh. So I don't know that you get to take the humor out of who you are in terms of how you see the world. Do I have the caption correct of the cow with the tag on her ear? She's staring straight at us, very sincere. I think your caption was something akin to, does my new earring make me look fat? Am I accurate on that one? I'm rolling in the aisles, and it was already sold, so I got to leave it there.
I'm happiest when a painting makes me smile for some reason. They're not jokes. They're not cartoons.
No, definitely. No, it isn't. It's more just about the ability to enjoy what you're looking at. Yeah. I mean, these are definitely not cartoonish. Real cows, real bulls, real horses.
That's the latest problem I'm trying to solve. And I don't know if it needs to be solved or it wants to be solved. But I find that I'm most comfortable painting representational stuff, paintings that look like the real thing I'm painting. But I also find it really boring. I need to push back. And I think the last 10 years of painting for me has just been technical exercise. Mm-hmm. Can I make something look like it looks to me? Local color, you know, expression, all that sort of thing. And yeah, I can kind of do that, I'm finding out. The next step for me is to make this artwork say something. And it may be a misstep. I don't know. And it terrifies me. I do study a lot of contemporary painters. And I frankly, I'm not a fan of most of what's done now because the craftsmanship doesn't seem to be there. Because I'm a fan of really good quality draftsmanship. And I don't see a lot of that. But the message, these guys are like really heavy on the message. And I am without message so far. And I want to try to find a way to marry those two. And if it doesn't work, then I'm happy with cows.
My question always is, how are we defining what a message is? Because I got that all the time in graduate school. What's your message?
Yeah.
Well, can it maybe just be that I like working in metal and want to make something that other people respond to in a favorable way? Do I have to be making a commentary? I don't know what a message is sometimes.
I took a studio art class, one studio art class at Arizona State. I don't think I would have lasted in art school or college, because it was all that class was about, you know, message. And we never painted a picture, we never drew anything in this art class for an entire semester. We just sat there and smoked cigarettes and talked about concept and message. And I wouldn't even smoke cigarettes. But it seemed like a good idea at the time, and I tried, and I was not successful at that either. But I never did come up with the line of BS that it took to get a good grade in art. And so that is a failure of mine so far, at least in to explain what I'm thinking, because I just let the painting talk, I guess. I don't know.
It's funny because when I sold the bakery, I went back to the art world because I had pretty much ignored it for the 15, 16 years that I had run the business. And my very first series of paintings were hyper-political and very, very critical of the Bush administration. And my first solo show was at Linnea's Cafe. And I actually invited the staff to come take a look at them before we hung the show. And I said, because this is going to affect your business. You're going to get people complaining. And they voted, let's go ahead and do the show. And it was a very successful show, created a tremendous amount of controversy. I got 3 death threats.
And there's message for you.
And they always say, you want people to react to your artwork, and that's a reaction.
But in point of fact, you've now gone several different directions since then. Mm-hmm. So when you're doing a still life of lemons, what's the message? Well, okay, Stephen.
I'm kind of like you. I like to throw something into the title that makes people think, like, what the heck does he mean by that? I think how you title a painting is incredibly important.
Mm-hmm. You know, my wife keeps telling me, and she's been right on almost everything in our lives, that she's saying that people don't buy a painting as much as they buy a story. It keeps bouncing off my head, but I keep hearing it.
And stories, guess what, are messages.
Stories are messages. But you're right, Stephen, the title can carry a whole lot of weight there.
I teach a marketing workshop for new artists who are participating in open studios every year for Arts Obispo. And that's one of the first things I tell them, is that it's not so much the image, it's the story behind the image that people purchase. Mm-hmm. That's what they want to know.
Mm-hmm. How long did it take you?
Yes. Well, that's my favorite one.
I've now said on air and to many others, the answer for me on that has become twofold. There's the technical thing of how long it actually may take, and then there's the thinking time. And since I can't figure out what that's going to be ahead of time,
I've seen that happen, showing people my paintings at an opening or a show and talking about them, that I've got that question, how long did this take you? You know, that some paintings, they jump out of the brush by themselves quickly, and some, you know, you have to sort of drag out. And I've, you know, proudly said, oh, this one just, it just happened, it was like a day. And they just walk away from that one.
I'm not paying this. For... No. There's forever going to be this sense that those that create are born with it. We have it. And the people that are saying, how long did that take, often feel that they don't have it, which is unfortunate because they probably do in some aspect of their life, right? So it's kind of the only way they know how to process something. And I would be the same way if I was talking to a chemist.
How long did it take you to cure cancer?
I'm a very cerebral painter, and I will work a painting over in my mind, sometimes for years, developing composition and color and everything about it, so that once I get the brush to canvas, I never sketch anything out. It goes quickly. It goes really, really quickly. I did a 5x8 foot self-portrait, and I thought about that painting for 2 years before I started it, and I finished it in 2 days. All the problems had been solved. Mm-hmm. And there's also a part of the painting, too, and I think of pretty much of any creative process. It at some point takes on a life of its own, and it tells you what it needs. Mm-hmm. And you just have to let that happen.
There's this one, this is basically a bottle shape. All of it comes apart into sections. It had originated as something else, and it wasn't going to work. And I'm lying in bed one morning, cold Michigan Sunday morning. I'm going, oh. And that's when I thought about cutting it apart and doing whatever I was going to do next. It just kept talking to me. Mm-hmm. Oh, let's do this here. It's fun when that happens.
Yeah, it's nice when they talk back.
Just don't tell anyone because they think you're nuts.
Or when they talk back and go, this is not working.
And they do that every once in a while.
Time to scrap this one. I'm going to go back to the message because that one, I think, really says an awful lot about sort of taking away or potentially taking away why we do what we do. If we're hung up on thinking that we have to meet some other criteria out there to qualify for it being something that somebody's going to call art, maybe I just need to do it.
That is probably the difference between an artist and someone who would like to be an artist is time in the studio, just doing it. And that's a lesson I learned, you know, early on with cartooning and later in painting, that it, maybe it doesn't really matter if it's going to be a masterpiece. It just matters that you're doing it and you're spending that 10,000 hours that it takes to learn something and master it, do it well. I don't think I'm about 5,000 hours into it now, and I have a long way to go. But boy, I just can't. It's very hard to describe the excitement and the joy that comes with a brushstroke. It just keeps me alive. It feeds me, and then I know that this is a thing that I need to do. And you've seen, I get a lot of paintings around here that are still here because either they haven't sold or I just choose to kind of have them around. But it almost doesn't matter what I'm painting. If it catches my interest, and probably is going to hurt my career because of this, because there's not a Jerry Scott kind of, you know, genre of paintings or direction or collection. But whether it's a peanut butter and jelly sandwich or a cow or a portrait or something, I get the same excitement no matter what it is I'm painting. But it has to be the thing. There's got to be that little chime I hear for me to have enough interest to start it and then finish it. So yeah, it doesn't matter what I paint, just that I paint.
Just out of curiosity and your enjoyment of being pretty realistic, are you taking photographs of the cow? Or are you sitting out there sketching it and then coming back in and reconstructing or combination?
I'm a slow drawer, so then and the cows move too fast. They are not cooperative. I do work from photographs almost exclusively. So I'll go to the roundups on the ranch, or I'll stop the car and get a picture if the light is good. And when it comes to the portraits, yeah, photography. I've never painted anything from life beyond a still life, something like that. So I paint with a computer screen next to the canvas, and if it's a really technically demanding painting, I can zoom in on an area till it's just a series of colors and shapes, and I can't recognize what it is I'm trying to paint. That's when I can really see, like, oh, this isn't a nose. This is just a little white there and a little purple there. And it just is a great way to get out of your head and paint what you see, not what you think you see. My next hurdle right now is improving my compositions and getting more consistent on successful compositions, because it seems like now that I get excited about the subject itself at the expense of the composition. I get started on the subject, you know, and I think, oh, wait, that's just a cow. But what if I was, 10 feet above the cow, or what if I, would move this or change or move it over to the edge, or that's what I need to look at next.
With the camera, you are making an initial composition. It may not be as complete as you want, but it seems to me that there's still a part of you then that has gotten intrinsically into that.
Got to be that element of interest. And then to adjust that image, that wonderful same computer I used, it's just given us this wealth of images, so that with Google you can type in view of a cow from 10 feet above and 100 of them come up. And because I didn't have the ladder handy, I know basically how the skull is shaped, but I just need to see how would the ear fall. You can almost always find it. We are so lucky now. It's such a beautiful tool.
I keep telling people that if Leonardo da Vinci was alive today, he'd be using computers and cameras.
And certainly the marble workers in Italy are using power tools. I think you probably answered this, but just as kind of a summation, these two aspects of your creative life, the cartoon strips and the painting, how do they influence each other, or do they?
I think they do. I think you observe that a lot of my paintings sort of inadvertently come with a smile. I think I'm most comfortable with that. So I think the comics inform the paintings in that way. Paintings help me get out of the smallness of the comics world. Writing a daily comic strip is a little like writing haiku. I'm limited to... people are going to start counting, but I try to limit myself to some 20, 25 syllables. I think the strongest comic strips have the fewest words in most cases. And as a writer, I have to pride myself on the economy of language and let the drawings carry the lion's share of the weight. I guess that the paintings allow me to break away from that and step away and get a longer view, the same way as I step back from the easel and get a longer view of a painting. You can find yourself, you know, with your shoulders hunched up around your ears, and I'm typing like with my fingers up around my nose and my nose on the keyboard, and it's not the best way to end up working, whether it's a painting or a comic strip.
Certainly bring pleasure. I will vouch for the fact that I take it in every day, and I miss it when I'm traveling. Even though there wasn't a storyline that I had to follow, except that all of a sudden Wren might now be crawling and like, wait, when did that happen? Anyway, Jerry, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Thank everybody who reads the comic strips. I mean, it is what keeps us all good-looking and intelligent, so keep reading them.
That's so good to know.
Thank you for a wonderful afternoon.
This month's guest has been Jerry Scott, who, along with Jim Borgman, produced the comic strip Zits. Jerry is also one half of the team that produces the comic strip Baby Blues with illustrator Rick Kirkman. Both strips appear in the Tribune, along with over 1,000 other newspapers around the world.
A good friend, an active member of the art community for many years here on the Central Coast, died this past week. Eleanor Klug was an amazingly talented woman. She and her husband were fabric designers in Chicago, and here on the Central Coast, she created metal and glass almost any way that she could think of. Her husband, Hank, died in 2007, and now the chapter is ended, except for all of the wonderful memories for many of us who had the good fortune to call them friends.
This has been a segment of Issues and Ideas called Ears on Art. Ears on Art is dedicated to the advancement and the exploration of the visual arts and is aired the first and second Wednesday of each month at 1:30 p.m. Ears on Art is produced at listener-supported KCBX Public Radio serving the California Central Coast. My name is Stephen DeLuque, and for co-host Krista Hewitt, we thank our loyal listeners.